It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's high school mascots run the gamut from the traditional to the bizarre. We'll look into the history of some of the most unique, from the ore dockers to the resorters. First, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 830 points yesterday and then bounced around a lot today. Other market indicators, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, didn't fare so great either. Both were down significantly yesterday and today. It's the first time in nearly 2 years that the market has seen stumbles like this. Market watchers are pointing to a number of issues that could be scaring investors, ranging from interest rate hikes to ongoing tariff battles. Akani Otani is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. Akani, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, with the close this afternoon, how big were the losses on the Dow Jones today?
So all told, we lost 545 points on the Dow today. So that's almost 1,300 points that we've lost over the last 2 days, and one of the worst two-day stretches for the market this year.
And we've talked before about this. These numbers, 1,300 points, sound pretty big when it comes to a percentage of the stock market value. We're going from much bigger starting points. So how big a deal is this in that perspective?
Yeah, so in the past, I mean, we've talked about how, you know, when the Dow can lose or gain several hundred points, it's not actually that big of a move. But actually, the moves that we've been seeing this week in the stock market have been pretty significant. Yesterday, we actually saw the largest one-day percentage decline since February. And today's move in the Dow is also ranking in the top 10 worst sell-offs for the Dow this year. So it has been pretty severe, what we've seen the last couple of days.
President Trump was interviewed on Fox News yesterday, asked whether trade policy from the White House might have something to do with the volatility of the market. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
We're taking in billions of dollars in tariffs from China, from Chinese goods, and it hasn't hurt us at all. We're taking in billions and billions of dollars. We're going to make product here that we're now buying in China. No, that wasn't it. The problem that I have is with the Fed. The Fed is going wild. I mean, I don't know what their problem is, but they're raising interest rates, and it's ridiculous.
And the president has talked about those interest rate increases today, too. Is this a reason maybe they're bumping up this important rate at the Fed? We'll get into what that is in a minute. But is this a plausible explanation for this drop in stocks?
When we talk to investors, that's certainly one of the things they mention. I mean, alongside trade, the Fed and its course of interest rates have been a key area of concern for investors throughout the year because, you know, for the last 9 years, we've seen U.S. stocks drive higher, and I think a lot of investors credit that in part to the fact that rates have been near historic lows for so long. And so when you're not getting that much out of treasuries, investors are more willing to take on risky investments like stocks. But recently, we've seen that dynamic increasingly change with the Fed raising interest rates to keep the economy from overheating. And so that's adding some more pressure to the market because investors are no longer dealing with this dynamic where, you know, bond yields across developed markets are carrying near zero rates.
Right. And I looked at a chart looking at those rates for the past, I don't know, 60 years or something. If you look at it in that whole time, they're kind of freakishly low still, even after these increases. You can find periods where they were in double digits, 10 up to 20%. They're pretty darn low, right, even after these increases.
That's right. And so, I mean, that's one reason why some people are still pretty optimistic about the stock market, even with the recent drops that we've seen, because they'll point out that, you know, even with the recent jump in bond yields that we've seen in the U.S., rates are still near historic lows. And when you think about it, the economy has managed to grow with rates at much higher levels than they are right now. But that being said, the pace of the bond yield gains that we've seen in the last week, I think, are really what's startling investors. Even if they're not concerned about rates being around 3.25% on the 10-year, they're saying the pace of the sell-off in the bond market is what is freaking people out.
And looking at the stock market, sometimes, and I'm guilty of this, people can use the stock market as a synonym for the economy. They're not the same thing. Performance in one does not necessarily indicate the performance of the other, right?
Totally. And that's what's kind of interesting about the sell-off that we've been seeing is that even with the severity of the drops, when we've talked to investors and asked them how they feel about the outlook for U.S. growth, they're still pretty optimistic. We have seen some weakness in areas of the economy like autos and housing recently, but on the whole, we have unemployment near multi-decade lows and measures of confidence among consumers and businesses at near records, and growth still projected to continue at a steady clip throughout the rest of the year. So, I mean, we're kind of seeing a dislocation at the moment between how investors feel the economy is doing and what we're seeing in the market.
Akani Otani is with us from the Wall Street Journal, looking at a couple of substantial drops 2 days in a row on Wall Street. And Akani, let's talk about the tariff side of the equation. President Trump says, no, that's not the reason, but I don't understand Wall Street, but I do understand people don't always like uncertainty, and there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding these back and forth tariffs. Is that part of the story here?
I mean, that's right. I think it's fair to say that tariffs have been another area of concern for investors throughout the year. I mean, it's kind of hard to, we'll never know what exactly caused the stock sell-off that we've seen throughout this week. But if you ask investors to sort of list all of the things that they're worried about, chances are they would mention interest rates and also tariffs, just because with tighter trade policies, we're really seeing the potential for U.S. corporate profits, which have been a very strong part, played a strong part in supporting the stock market, potentially start to slow down a little bit. It doesn't look like we're at the breaking point yet, but we are starting to see some companies mention that tariffs have started to eat into their profits in recent quarters, or sort of muddy their investment plans. So how severe those tariffs end up being will certainly be a key area that investors will be looking at.
We've seen stories lately about just how huge some of the technology companies are, things like Apple, Google, Amazon, for example, just head and shoulders in terms of their valuation above other things. How much does a little wiggle from one of those companies affect the greater stock market?
It's a surprising amount. We've done a couple stories throughout the year about how just a handful of the so-called FANG stocks, so you're talking Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, have actually driven an outsized portion of the stock market's gains. And this isn't necessarily unusual when you look at market history. It's pretty normal for a handful of companies and dominant industries to actually produce most of the S&P 500's gains, just because it is a market cap-weighted index. So bigger companies tend to have an outsized role in driving where the stock market is going at any given time. But that has been an area of concern, because when these names do tumble, they can sort of take the broader market down with them.
This story over the last couple of days of dropping stock values, is this a U.S. story or is this a global story?
It's very much global, and that's what's interesting as well, because for a lot of the year, we saw U.S. stocks really outperforming their counterparts overseas, and investors were attributing that to the strength of the U.S. economy, even as momentum seemed to be slowing in the Eurozone and emerging markets. But clearly right now, we're seeing a sort of reversal of that, where stocks from Europe to Japan to Hong Kong to New York, they're all falling in tandem.
I want to get back to those interest rates for a moment. They're a tool. When we have a recession, the Federal Reserve can cut those interest rates to try to give a jump start to the economy. That's what we saw with the Great Recession, a big drop in those rates. Is it a worry that they're low enough now that if we go into another recession, which we will someday, that their toolkit is limited because they can only take them down so far?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when we talk to investors, particularly in the bond world, about what's going to happen the next time we slip into recession, many sort of concede they're not quite sure, because we've already taken rates, near historic lows this time around. And investors don't think a recession is that far off. I mean, most of the folks we've talked to don't think a recession is imminent, but at the same time, you hear, 2020, 2019 sort of being tossed around. So when you think about that, and when you think about where rates will likely be the next time the economy starts contracting, it does sort of pose a conundrum for the Fed as far as how much lower they can feasibly bring rates down.
We'll leave it there and watch what happens tomorrow. Akani, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Akani Otani is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. She joined us for a look at the drop in the Dow Jones yesterday and today, and some wider perspective on what's going on in the market. A school's team name and mascot can send a message for better or worse. Native American mascots continue to be a source of controversy in sports around the country. It's an issue we've talked about in the past here on Central Time. Today, though, we're going to focus on Wisconsin's most unique and memorable mascots, from the Clintonville Truckers to the Eau Claire Memorial Old Abes. Coming up with a unique team name takes creativity, knowing your area, and not taking yourself too seriously, something that Saturday Night Live has gotten into. Here's guest star Dabney Coleman with the SNL cast circa 1980-something, trying to come up with a team name.
What if we call ourselves the Super Winners?
Now, see, that's really dumb.
That was my mom's idea.
All right, let's compromise. The Flaming Eagles.
No! The Sculptors.
What about the Cover Girls?
Doors. The Flaming Mafia.
Oh, what is that? The Titanics.
No, the Rambos.
I don't see what's wrong with the Capybaras, you guys.
The Snipers.
We want to know what your favorite mascot in the state is. High school, college, or something else is your favorite team have a unique offbeat name? Do you know the story behind it? How that unusual name get put into a costume? What do you think makes for a great mascot? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Lainey Seiler is a pop culture and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She recently wrote about some of Wisconsin's quirkiest mascots. Lainey, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I came from a high school called the Tigers, really non-creative there. There are a lot of Spartans and Wildcats and Eagles. What put you on the path, though, of finding the more unique names in Wisconsin?
I went to a school. We were the Indians and changed halfway through to the Patriots, so sort of in my backstory, but then coming to Wisconsin, I'm not from here. So coming to Wisconsin, you're like, okay, what is the Hodag? It kind of stands out as like, that's not a thing, right? Or should I know what this is? So kind of looked into, you know, what starting with the Hodag and then kind of stumbled upon so many interesting names for high schools. And they're, you know, it's across the country. There's a lot of fun regional names for high schools, nicknames, but Wisconsin seems to have quite a few. The Hodags is just the tip of the iceberg. That's in Rhinelander. There's also the Kakana Galloping Ghosts, going way, way up north to, let's see, Washburn. They have the Castle Guards nearby in Mellon. It's the Granite Diggers. Ashland is the Ore Docker. So it's like very fun kind of historical names and some new ones thrown in. So it was very fun to kind of get stories from people and hear where they came up with these creative, clever, fun nicknames for their high schools.
And let's get into some of those. And you had an online poll for people to pick their favorites at the Journal Sentinel there. And that you mentioned the Rhinelander Hodags. They were number one. And this, it is a perfect storm of a mascot, right? It's like got a local connection. It's unique. It's a fearsome creature. Talk a little bit about the Rhinelander Hodag.
Yeah, so the Rhinelander Hodag, it is not real. Some guy, this guy.
Well, there's
Eugene
still debate
Shepherd.
On that, right? No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, true, arguable. This man named Eugene Shepherd in 1893, so it has quite a backstory. He made it up as sort of a prank to lure tourists to, like, the logging industry was kind of dying down up north. So he had this idea of, like, luring tourists, and he also just kind of, like, liked to have fun. So it became this sort of, like a fun way to like draw people in, and it has endured in the town to this day. So they did like a fake hunt for a Hodag. They had like this puppet that appeared at a county fair there. So it goes on and on. There's like stores in Rhinelander. There's a giant statue of a Hodag in Rhinelander. And of course it's their high school mascot. So it's definitely the mascot for the town, which is the case for a lot of these schools, but this one has taken on its own larger than life persona.
And there's one that I wanted to have a backstory, the Kakana, you mentioned the Galloping Ghosts. I wanted them to have their local legend of Sleepy Hollow or something like that. There's nothing like that though. That's a different kind of story.
That's a different one. It's this one dates back, I think it was to the 40s when they the Kakana Galloping Goat, or the Kakana team, was playing the Appleton Terrors, and a reporter wrote about how the team was, they had white uniforms, and they just, like, they beat the Appleton Terrors, who were a really good team, and it looked like they were ghosts galloping over the opponents. And it was like a Halloween game, so it kind of it stuck. And then their school really just, like, leaned into this mascot, and the principal at one point invited a student to ride their horse to the game. So it just became this huge tradition that they still do today. And today their mascot is actually a 9-year-old girl. They need someone who knows how to handle a horse. And so she's a student in their school district, not at their high school. She rides on the field and, like, delivers the game ball to the referees at football games.
And you wrote that, I think it was one of the administrators is in charge of cleaning up after the horse itself.
Yeah, I spoke with them, and he said, yeah, it usually falls on me. And they just got a new, like, AstroTurf field, so they have to keep it very nice. And so, yes, that's, you know, doing the dirty work too for the athletic directors.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Haley is with us in Cudahy. Haley, hello.
Hi.
Which mascot did you want to tell us about, Haley?
In Fremont, Illinois, there's a high school, and their mascot is the Pretzels.
Oh, I've heard about that. Yeah. Do we have a pretzel in Wisconsin too, or is that just the one I've heard about?
I don't think so.
And Haley, is somebody in some kind of pretzel costume, do you know?
Yeah. Yeah. They like run around at games and just like a twisted salty pretzel.
All right. Haley, thank you so much. And that reminds me of a good food themed one in Wisconsin. I think you wrote about it, the Cheesemakers of Monroe.
Yeah, I didn't write about that one, but there's the Cheesemakers. There's also the Papermakers. There's two Papermakers. So there are a lot of, like, jobs-based ones. I'm not sure what they do for the Cheesemaker, if they serve cheese at their games, or if they dress up as a wedge of cheese. I'm sure there's lots of Packers cheese.
Oh, yeah, that's a gimme, sure. That's great. But I love, that's a common theme you found, like, something in local industry, the ore dockers, mm-hmm. too, up in Ashland. And were they one that used to be a pergolder just because their colors were purple and gold?
They were. That was an interesting one. I actually spoke or emailed with there was a young sports writer who was, I think, maybe 17, 18, or 19 in the 40s who decided that pergolders was too boring. And so he decided he was going to give them a new name, and it was for the ore dockers. They used to ship all this ore out of that region. That school is, or that town is right on Lake Superior, and they would ship ore from the region out of these huge docks. And so that was a job that people had, was to, like, make sure that the ore made it from the train down into these huge ships. So those were the ore dockers, and now they don't have those docks anymore, but they are still the ore dockers in memory of those of their past.
I've got a note. Dennis in Coon Valley called in to mention the Watertown Goslings. That sounds like an adorable mascot.
That was a popular one, yeah.
And I've got a picture here of the Freeport pretzel mascot, and yeah, it's a full-on pretzel twist. A person inside this outfit. I wasn't sure how they'd pull that off, but it works. You got to look online to find the picture,
okay,
but it really does
we'll
work.
Okay, we'll have to check that.
Google were there challenges for some of these in finding, Lainey, for some of these schools in finding, okay, we've got this great name, now how do we represent that as a mascot?
Yes, I have two fun ones for that. I think the Resorters are probably the most creative in their, I mean, that's a fun opportunity. Their actual physical mascot, they're from Elkhart Lake in Glen Beulah. So their actual mascot is an elk, but the students dress up as if they're on vacation as their theme days. So that's pretty fun.
So Resorters, like, as in shirts. A resort. Yeah.
Yep. Because that was a popular resort destination at the turn of the century. So that one's fun. And then the Granite Diggers are very, very proud of their Chipper, the chipmunk mascot. They have a lot of black granite there, and I guess there were a lot of chipmunks running around these piles of granite. So they decided that, you know, it was sort of like a double, like their animal mascot could just be. So Chipper is a granite digger. He has a pickaxe.
Fair. Okay. And I saw granite digger, I was assuming it was Wisconsin State Rock, the red granite, but no, it's not the red granite up there.
Yeah, nope. It's the I guess they have. There's black granite. It's very. It gets shipped, or it used to get shipped all over. I don't know if it still does.
And now, one thing Wisconsin is not known for is castles, but we've got the Washburn High School Castle Guards. How did that come to be?
That one came to be. They're also known for granite, and they had this granite was used to build some buildings, and so it was used to build their school, and the school. The old school used to look like a mask, or it used to look like a castle, and so and it looked over their football field. So when they would play, they would say, "Oh, it looks like the football team is guarding the castle." Unfortunately, that school did burn down, and their replacement school does not look like a castle. But in homage to their former school building, they have kept the mascot.
And so the mascot dresses as what, some kind of medieval castle guard or something?
Yeah, it's a knight basically. Okay. So yeah.
So any others that we haven't gotten into that you were excited to see?
Well, a lot of people disagreed. They thought that I, you know, skipped over quite a few. Some people were very, very impassioned about the Old Abes, the Eau Claire Memorial High School Old Abes. So, and that's mascot has quite a history in Wisconsin. The Old Abe is the name of this eagle that a Civil War regiment actually brought into battle in the Civil War, named after Abraham Lincoln. The eagle is named after Abraham Lincoln. After the Civil War, the eagle went to the state capitol and died in the state capitol in a fire. And then there is a replica now still that you can see of Old Abe. And so this one high school in Eau Claire has it as their mascot. So it's an eagle, but his name is Old Abe, and it has this very Wisconsin history to it.
It's a great place to leave it. Lainey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lainey Seiler is a pop culture and entertainment reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to talk about some of Wisconsin's most unique, memorable, and downright strange mascots and team names. You can share your favorites at Central Time WPR on Twitter. Young people are often credited or blamed for killing certain trends. Examples include real estate, American cheese, and now divorce might be joining the list. New analysis of U.S. Census Bureau survey data shows that young people, Generation X and especially millennials, are getting married later and divorced less often. It's leading to an overall decline in the U.S. divorce rate, which dropped 18% between 2008 to 2016. Our next guest studies modern families and joins us to explore what this means for our culture. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what do we know about young people and when they do and don't get married?
Well, there's all sorts of interesting changes going on. The fact is that divorce rates have been falling for some time, contrary to popular opinion, but they're particularly falling for younger people, although part of that's because they're getting married at older ages. There have been a lot of changes in marriage patterns that seem to be contributing to the greater stability of marriage. One of that is the fact that people are getting married at older ages. And for every year, a woman postpones her first marriage right up to her 50s. With one little dip between the ages of about 35 and 37, she reduces her chance of divorce. The other thing is, of course, that more people are getting a college education, and that seems to be increasingly important for marriage today, both because it is increasingly the only route to financial security, and also because it demonstrates, you know, a certain maturity, a willingness to think things through, and negotiation is much more important to marriage than it used to be. There are a lot of other reasons, too, but I don't want to go on too long.
Sure. Well, I want to look at another part of that younger generation, though, where it's a different story, where people, especially people who aren't economically secure, are often not getting married in the first place, so obviously they're not getting divorced.
Yes. That's another part of the selection factor. And that's the there's a lot of good news, and I'd like to come back to the good news, some of the changing factors for divorce and versus the things that now keep a marriage stable. There's a lot of good news there. But that's the bad news that we're talking about. As our expectations of marriage have become much higher, as women have enough economic independence not to have to put up with abuse or other kind of problems in the marriage, but also at the same time as economic security has weakened for people without a college education, marriage has become a riskier enterprise than it used to be. It used to be that really it was your only way to settle down, and for a woman, the only way she could get some support from a man because she couldn't earn her own way. Now there's a question is when we compare investing in our own earnings power versus marrying someone that could end in divorce, who might not be willing to pay to or able to bear his or her fair share, people are very reluctant to get married. They also have higher standards for intimacy, and that's, I think, a good thing. We know that domestic violence has been falling dramatically because people no longer put up with this kind of behavior. But all of those things mean that for people under stress or chronic economic insecurity, marriage has become a great thing if you can marry someone who you can count on, but a risky thing if you, in fact, are going to be under that kind of stress that might lead to divorce.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz from Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, looking at changing trends, divorce rates going down. We're also getting married at different times in different ways. And Stephanie, this is a part of the story I know you've been looking at a lot, and some amazing, just huge changes, cohabiting, people living together, not married. Talk about how that's changed and how our attitudes toward that have changed.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago when it was just living in sin was just considered terrible. Today, only 17% of Americans disapprove of cohabiting before marriage. And the majority of marriages do begin with premarital cohabitation. Cohabitation is a complex subject because there's two types of cohabitation. One is the cohabitation of people who've known each other for a while, who think that they probably will get married, move in together, live together for a while, and then go on to get married. We used to think that cohabiting before marriage was a risk factor for divorce, but it turns out that that's not true. In fact, there are some segments of the population where cohabiting before marriage with the intent to marry actually improves your chances of the marriage staying together. But there's another kind of cohabitation, and that is when people are under economic insecurity and they don't have, they need to move in together. They feel financially, they'd like to get married. They're not quite ready financially, but they're also not able to maintain two households. And there, in that sector of the population, you get cohabitation occurring much earlier in the relationship with much greater possibility that it won't be a good match. And that in itself shows some of the changes. It used to be, back in the 1950s, the average couple who married knew each other for only 6 months. Today, that would be a huge risk factor for divorce because marriage is so much more individualized and requires so much more negotiation. So when people move in together too fast nowadays, they often don't proceed to marriage at all.
And Stephanie, something I've seen anecdotal reporting on, and maybe you'll know if there's data on how often this happens, where you'll see those cohabiting couples in economically insecure conditions breaking up, but they can't afford two rents. They're cohabiting post-breakup. Is that something we know about how widespread it is?
I don't know how widespread that is. Again, I've seen the anecdotal accounts too, and as a historian, I know that this happened a lot during the Great Depression. I've interviewed people, oldsters I interviewed in the past, about living the Great Depression. Some of them talked about putting a curtain down the living room because they couldn't afford to move out. So the divorce rate fell madly in the Great Depression, but that didn't mean that marriages were better.
Now let's look at the baby boomers. As I understand it, they are the ones who drove these higher divorce rates. How are they doing now as they age?
Well, I think that it's true that the baby boomers did drive it, and I think that part of that was because they came of age in a period when gender roles were changing very, very rapidly, and women's expectations were rising more quickly about those changes than men's behavior. And I think that since that time, I think one of the reasons that divorce rates have stabilized is that men and women are adjusting to the new sort of rules of marriage and the new gender norms. And we, for example, know that men, up until the 1980s, if a woman had more education than her husband, that was a risk factor for divorce. if she earned more than her husband, that's a risk factor for divorce. Both those things are not true for marriages formed since the 1990s, and that's another reason why young people, I think, are doing so well. The baby boomers have had, many of them have had divorces earlier and then gone on to other marriages, some very successful, but once you've divorced once, it's easier to divorce again. And we saw between 1990 and 2010, we saw a tripling of divorces of couples aged 65 and older, and a doubling of divorces of couples aged 50 and older. That's leveled off now. And there, I think there's some disagreement. Demographer Philip Cohen, who's a much more skilled at numbers than I, thinks we're going to see a continuing declining rate of divorce among older people. I'm not sure about that because older divorces are different than younger divorces. Older divorces are usually because you've just grown apart. You've got an empty shell marriage, and people nowadays are not willing to put up with that, and they have lots of alternatives outside of it. So I would say that anybody getting married now should recognize that marriage nowadays, our expectations of it are such that there's, yes, your chances of divorce go down the longer you're married, but they don't disappear, and it's really important to keep working on that relationship in a way that might not have been in the past when people just felt like they didn't have any alternative.
We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz, professor at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and director of research for the Council on Children, Council on Contemporary Families, talking about declining rates of divorce and changing trends in marriage and divorce and living together in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and maybe your story. Have you and your partner lived together as a couple without getting married, or because you're waiting to get married? Do you feel like people are judging you on that, or is it just cool nowadays? Have you watched attitudes toward that change over the years? Are you seeing younger people in your circle choosing not to get married at all for whatever reason, economic or otherwise? Are you seeing people in your community, your group of friends getting married or divorced? What's your experience like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. We're picking up our conversation about marriage, divorce, and living together. Stephanie Kuntz is with us from the Evergreen State College in Washington. She's director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What weighed on your decision on whether or not to get married, whatever generation you might be, or whether or not to get divorced? How about living together? And do you see a generation gap between you and your parents or kids or grandparents or grandkids' generation on the decision to get married and how you think about it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie, it seems like there's a lot of pressure on marriage. It's an economic unit. It's you're supposed to like each other, love each other. You're raising kids together. You're doing the logistics together. We put a lot of weight on a marriage. It's surprising in some ways you don't have more divorce.
True. I mean, the higher your expectations, the more possibility there is of disappointment. Now, I've heard some people say, well, we should lower our expectations of marriage. And having spent a lot of my time studying the history of marriage over thousands of years, I would say I would certainly advise against that, because low expectation marriages were often pretty miserable indeed. But I think that it is important to be realistic about our expectations, and I think that people are becoming more realistic, that instead of the romantic attraction of opposites, there is a sense that nowadays married couples should be friends. They should share interests. They should share skills and resources, not just specialize. And in fact, one of some of the most interesting research we have coming out is a total reversal in what seems to make people happiest in a marriage. For marriages formed in the 60s, 70s, and even early 80s, a traditional division of labor with the man doing most of the breadwinning and the woman doing most of the child care and the housework seemed to make people happiest. But for marriages formed since the early 90s, That's not true. The couples who share breadwinning, housework, and child care report the happiest marriages. They report the best sex lives, and they're the only couples having more sex than couples in the past. So these are all good news things. When you look around, it appears that we are beginning to adjust to these changing gender roles. But as you say, there is the economic expectation. It's very hard nowadays to have just a single provider family. People talk about how single parent families are having trouble, but one earner parent families are also having trouble. And so it becomes not only for your personal life and intimacy, becomes an economic issue of whether you're going to marry somebody who doesn't bring a load of debt and who is employable and willing to do their fair share.
Stephanie, in my head, big changes like that on this key cultural institution are things that happen really slowly, and it takes generations. It sounds like some of these attitudes toward living together, toward what makes a good marriage, have changed really pretty quickly in the scope of human history.
They have, and you know, it's been surprising just how fast they've changed. Some people, you know, I have friends who say, oh, it's so slow to change. My husband still says this to me, still doesn't do this. And I think, my goodness, when you look back at what marriage was like in the 1950s and 60s, and for my last book, A Strange Stirring, I interviewed women from those families and men, too, and what their marriages were like, the change is just kind of astounding. Yes, we have a ways to go. There are ways in which both genders hold on to older ideas that get in the way of their getting the most out of their marriages.
Let's go to our callers now. Raj is on the line in Eau Claire. Raj, hello.
Yes, yes.
What did you want to bring up, Raj?
Yeah, I think I want to add a point where, my comment is on the discussion. Today's topic is the best thing to avoid all those, divorce or some kind of breakups and all. Communication is more important to today's generation because what I do generally with my family, I keep on communicating every week how things going on, what we need to do next. You know, everything is fine, or we need something, or we need to work on something. Do I'm doing anything wrong, or do you want me to cut myself in some things? Or, you know, that is what I generally do with my kids and with, with my wife. And I'm at the same time, I take feedback from the elders, grandparents, like how you guys used to do, how you guys used to handle the situation.
All right, Raj, thanks a lot for calling in. Stephanie, are there studies on how couples communicate and how that affects the risk of divorce, or in a more positive way, how it benefits their success?
Well, of course, people need to communicate. They need to negotiate. One very interesting counterintuitive study showed that couples who bicker in the first 3 years of marriage actually are less likely to divorce and happier in the long run than couples who don't discuss these things. Because when you've got two people coming nowadays with pretty much equal resources, with a lot of experience, they're going to have to figure out how it works, and not just one person, as so many of the marriages that I've read about and that I interviewed people about in the 50s, with the woman saying, well, whatever you want, dear, whatever you want, dear. So, yes, communication is more important than ever. People have, people don't have to fight fair. I mean, in fact, it's almost impossible, research shows, to fight fair when you're really angry. The most important thing is to be able to repair afterwards, to have more good exchanges afterwards, to have some humor when you've had a disagreement. But disagreements are going to be, they're absolutely important in marriages of equals,
Raj, thanks for that call. We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Council on Contemporary Families, looking at declining divorce rates, how younger people are getting married less often, in some cases later, being a little more selective, and that's part of the story of divorce rates. Back to your calls. Sam is on the line in Eau Claire. Sam, hello.
Hey.
Hi, what did you want to bring up?
I was just wondering if your guest had any comments about how the legalization of gay marriage has impacted divorce rates in our country. I'm imagining there was a bit of a tidal wave in around about 2009 as different states and then the federal government legalized gay marriage. And I'm sure there are hundreds of couples that have been living together for decades sometimes who suddenly were able to turn what had been essentially a marriage into a legal marriage. And what does that do to the numbers?
Sam, thanks for the call. Stephanie?
Well, that's a very good question. I wish I could answer it because we're just studying these things now. Of course, the fact that some of these new marriages had in fact gone on for a long time in one sense reduces the divorce risk. On the other hand, as soon as you get more people marrying, you have more chance of divorce. So I think that's a great question that we're just going to have to continue to study. But one of the real benefits, it seems to me, of same-sex marriage is that same-sex couples have more experience than we heterosexual couples have of figuring out how to divide the roles at home and at work, not on the basis of gender stereotypes of what sex you are, but on the basis of who's good at what and who wants to do what and what's the fairest way to do that. And so in some ways they can provide a model for heterosexual couples.
Thanks for the call, Sam. Stephanie, I know it could be tough. Things are happening today, but we won't have the numbers on them in many cases for a couple few years from now. So that said, what kind of emerging trends are you watching for right now?
Well, you know, I'm a historian, and we hate to predict the future.
Right, I won't ask you to.
But I think that you've got two countervailing trends here. One really positive one is the increased, despite all the bad stuff that we read in the newspapers that is coming out, precisely because people are able to speak up more now, the changes in acceptance of gender equality are really quite impressive, and couples are doing marriage better, more fairly than ever in the past. Domestic violence rates have declined immensely. People are spending more time with their kids. They're collaborating more. These are all very good things. But just as we were talking about at the beginning of the program, you have this other thing where socioeconomic trends are going in the opposite direction, dividing us, making people feel more insecure. There was a study recently by some psychologists who found that the best predictor of negative interactions between couples is not their family background, their values, whether they were a product of divorce themselves, but how much economic tension and stress they're under. So that's a real threat to marriage.
And Stephanie, as you mentioned, you've looked at marriage over long periods of time in the United States and elsewhere. Have you seen anything like we're seeing in the United States and maybe some other countries around the world in the present?
Well, there's a lot of things that we've seen in the past that have come around in new forms, but actually this is really unheard of. Never before in history have we tried, as many people are trying today, to develop a marriage system that is not based on coercion, on whether it's by parents or by social approval or by economic necessity, that is based upon real individual choice and is based upon equality and exchange between couples where every member of the family, both the adults and the children, are expected to be valued equally. This is a huge social experiment. I think it's a wonderful one. But it's no wonder it takes us a while.
It's a good place to leave it. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. And there's still time for you to share your stories and your observations when it comes to marriage, divorce, and living together in the modern United States. We just heard Stephanie say this is, in many ways, unprecedented, a social experiment, one that she likes. How is it playing out for you and your family? Did you cohabit, live together before getting married, instead of getting married? How did that work for you? What do you think of that change in American attitudes toward cohabitation? You can let us know, email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. As the Milwaukee Brewers get ready for the next stage in their playoff run, there are two behind-the-scenes stories for lovers of dogs and or beer. Central Time producer and Brewers superfan Bill Martins is here. Hey, Bill.
Did you say beer?
I did. And dogs.
Got my attention.
Adorable dogs. So Hank the dog.
Right.
It's been a bit of a mystery. People are wondering. Tell us that little backstory on Hank the dog.
Okay, I couldn't believe this was back in 2013 when this
that
happened.
Long ago.
So like 5 years ago. It was spring training. Brewers have their spring training facility in Maryvale, Arizona. And this dog just shows up one day out of the blue, and you could tell
stray dog.
Right, stray dog, white fluffball little thing, looked like he had a pretty rough life. Brewers actually made an effort to try to find the owner of this dog, didn't find one, so they took him in themselves, took him back to Milwaukee, and then marketed the heck out of this thing and
right.
made a ton of coin off him, and and you know, it became a fan favorite. But then you just kind of stopped hearing
off the
about
radar.
Him. Yeah. So the Journal Sentinel rolled out this story about, hey, what happened to Hank? And it turns out that he's actually staying with like the family of a brewer, attorney, or something like
they
that.
They adopt him. They have kids.
Yeah. And he apparently makes very rare occasions, but he's still kind of there, but on off to the side.
So Hank the dog's still around and probably in a better home than living in a baseball stadium.
I would
for
think
a dog.
So. Yeah.
And then the beer, now the Miller Coors Company in that Colorado-Milwaukee playoff. There's Coors Field in Denver.
Yep.
Miller Park. They promised free beer to the winner, and it's coming?
It's coming to Milwaukee, and I'm just letting you right now. I'm going to be working from Milwaukee tomorrow,
okay.
So don't bother me.
So bars around Milwaukee. Again, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has a list of bars with free Miller Lite. This is Central Time.